Hurricane Dorian is still lingering off the coast. The Bahamas have taken an unspeakable amount of damage. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Dorian has lessened in strength and has begun moving northward, but that means the southern part of the storm is still sitting over parts of the island chain. Today we'll learn more about relief efforts to the Bahamas and what you could do to help. Also, if storms are getting stronger, how can we make our communities more resilient? And how will insurance change in hurricane-prone places? And finally, we want to hear from parents. How do we talk to our kids about storms? How do you help them avoid PTSD? Call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, as you probably just heard, Hurricane Dorian losing some of its power, but picking up speed, also growing in size, and leaving in its wake a lot of destruction in the Bahamas. Still moving slowly up the East Coast, so Palm Beach County is going to be feeling some stuff still for a little while. We're joined now by Jeff Huffman, Chief Meteorologist for the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. So, Jeff, we just heard the report. Again, the storm losing some of its strength at Category 2 now, but getting bigger in size. That sounds great. It's not a 5, it's a 2, but let's remind people, a 2 is still very powerful.
It is, and the wind field has expanded far enough now that we are confident tropical storm sustained winds will likely occur from north of West Palm Beach all the way to the Florida-Georgia line, and probably as far inland at least as I-95. It's also important to note that this appears to be more of a wave action and storm surge problem now along the Treasure Coast and the Space Coast. The surge is expected to be 4 to 7 feet, but those locations, in addition to that rise in water, this persistent pounding of the wind from the east-northeast has brought some significant waves ashore. We're talking wave heights now in the 10 to 15-foot range sitting just offshore, and that will only compound the problem along the coast.
So for folks, again, living in Palm Beach County, they're not out of the woods yet. What can they expect over the next 24 hours?
Well, if you know, the coastline changes in its direction when you go up to Palm Beach County. So we have a coastline that kind of moves north-northeast just to West Palm Beach. And then by the time you get to Jupiter, the coastline moves, it kind of moves in a more north-northwest direction. Where that apex of that turn is, there's going to be a significant difference between the coastal effects north of that slight turn in the coast versus south of there. So when you get up to Port St. Lucie and Fort Pierce, significant wave action, coastal flooding, beach erosion, and some storm surge occurring. South of that turn, conditions will not be as severe, but we already have reports of coastal flooding in Palm Beach County. Water has now moved over the seawall, and it's already moved 10 feet past the fence line there, 3 miles northeast of Riviera Beach. So that report just came in. Looking at another report here that's further up north in St. Augustine. But we're getting reports now of coastal flooding quite solidly from West Palm Beach northward.
You know, this storm was basically almost stationary over the Bahamas for almost 20 hours plus. What caused the storm to slow down to 1 mile per hour and just sit there?
Well, the steering currents pretty much collapsed. Remember, a hurricane is pushed along by winds really high up in the atmosphere, and those winds weakened, and there was just nothing to move it in any particular direction. Now, a hurricane wants to move poleward. It's in its nature to move toward the north. You know, it's transferring all this heat and energy from the equator to the pole. That's pretty much the cycle of a hurricane. So anything that's blocking it from moving to the north usually causes it to go west, and we had a high pressure ridge kind of over it to the north that was forcing it west. That high pressure ridge was going through a process of weakening. At the same time, we have now a weakness in the atmosphere that will allow the hurricane to move north. It's not uncommon for a hurricane to stall before it turns. This particular stall was painfully slow. And finally now, I think you heard me say off the top of the hour, every mile per hour counts. We now are up to 3. It's moving northwest at 3.
Has that made predicting this storm difficult?
Well, yes and no. The forecast confidence has increased based on the forecast data that's available to us. But anytime a storm stalls, then, of course, you get a little nervous. Something could come along and cause it to wobble or shift here or there. I think it's more been more of a human toll in terms of the painful process of waiting for this thing to move. We took a lot of social media anxiety the last 2 days in our Facebook Lives, because when you see something like this barreling westward, you know, 50 years ago, there would have been chaos here in Florida, because we would not have had the science and technology and the forecasting capabilities of so confidently saying it's going to turn to the north.
And talking about that anxiety and social media, we're going to talk about a little bit of that later in the program. You talked about this being a storm surge situation, but as it moves northward, is it going to be more of a rain kind of system or a wind system?
Well, both of those hazards are slightly a little less ominous than the storm surge. So there certainly will be heavy rain. We think now 4 to 6 inches of rain along and east of I-95, 2 to 4 inches of rain as far west potentially as the turnpike up to Orlando, and then lesser amounts further to the west coast. We already have several rain bands rotating across the entire peninsula. When it comes to the winds, right now we're forecasting, we have a hurricane warning in effect, because there certainly could be hurricane force wind gusts up and down the A1A and the east of the I-95 corridor. The sustained hurricane force winds are likely to stay offshore now. That's good news, or at least better news. But tropical storm force winds, as you may know, can cause trees to come down, and those could extend as far inland as possibly Orlando. I think certainly Volusia and Seminole County, all the way down to Osceola, Indian River, Okeechobee, and Martin counties could see tropical storm force sustained winds.
All right, I got to let you go, but let me ask you this. There are a couple of the disturbances going on out there.
Yeah.
What are we watching?
Tropical depression formed in the Gulf. It's heading west. There's a couple other waves in the Atlantic. Right now, no immediate concern from those. But we are, of course, in the thick of things, in the heart of hurricane season.
Definitely something to remember. This is the heart of hurricane season. Jeff Huffman, again, chief meteorologist for the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thank you so much for all the updates.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, still to come, we hear about some of the strangest ways that people have wanted to stop a hurricane. Believe it or not, lots of weird ones. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, as Hurricane Dorian continues to travel north up Florida's coast, forecasters again continue to struggle to adequately predict what it's going to do next. As we recently just heard from Jeff Huffman, it's hard to tell sometimes. Mother Nature is not easy to predict. Hugh Willoughby is a professor of Florida International University's Department of Earth and Science. He's studied hurricane behavior for years. He's a former meteorologist for the federal government. Willoughby was also the director of the Hurricane Research Division of NOAA's Atlantic, Oceanic, and Oceanographic, and Meteorological Laboratory until 2002. And he's joining us now. Professor Willoughby, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
And again, I just want to make a note, too, by the way, this hour we are awaiting a news conference with Governor Ron DeSantis to get an update on the storm that may be coming a little later in the program. So, Professor, in all your years, have you ever seen a hurricane do what Dorian has done, which is basically almost just stop?
Actually, I've seen it a couple of times in recent years. Think about Hurricane Harvey in Houston a couple of years back, and Hurricane Florence in the Carolinas. You can make an argument. This isn't peer-reviewed scientific research, but just an observation. As the planet gets warmer, what's really happening is most of the warming is concentrated in the Arctic. And the thing that makes the west winds and mid-latitudes and the trade winds in the tropics go is the cyclones that exist outside of the tropics. And as the Arctic gets warmer, that whole process slows down. So I think that this gap in the high pressure system that where Dorian sat and where Harvey sat is maybe related to global warming. It may just be bad luck too. When we have a little more experience, we'll be able to do some statistics and decide. So this may be something that we're going to see more of.
And I want to talk to you about that here, but in a moment, something interesting too is, again, some of your background. With the research that you've done over the years, you've also had the chance to fly in the Hurricane Hunter planes. And these are the planes, again, that fly through the storm, collecting all kinds of data. Tell me about the importance that information that you're gathering that you have to fly through a storm in order to get it.
Okay, there are two kinds of flying. One is what the Air Force mostly does, which is to go out there every day and fly into the storm, tell the forecasters where it is, how strong it is. Then there's research flying. The NOAA P-3s are the main airplanes that do that now. And what their mission has become is improving the representation of the hurricane in the numerical models. So they make observations. They have copies of the models that they fiddle with to make them more accurate. In meteorology, there's this butterfly effect where the flapping of a butterfly's wings in Orlando could cause a typhoon in Hong Kong 2 weeks later. Well, every approximation you make in a model is one little butterfly flapping its numerical wings. And so my former colleagues spend their time improving the way surface friction works, improving the way rain works, putting all these things, making them more like reality. Of course, they're never actually like reality in complete detail. One of the things that was kind of cool about Dorian is the models pretty much predicted what would happen. And as time went on, the forecast tracks got closer and closer together. It's been a nail biter for everybody. But the forecasts have been frustrating because the events happened so slowly. It hasn't been badly forecast.
You know what? I wondered what it was like, in those planes, the perspective you get of a hurricane from there compared to, again, looking at radar. What was that like?
Well, the airplanes have good radar, so you look at the radar a lot.
Yeah. Honestly,
there's a whole lot about it that's just sublimely beautiful. You see things and have experiences that just don't happen to anybody else. The Edward R. Murrow famous quote, if an adequate definition of humility is ever written, it'll be written in the eye of a hurricane. I could tell you tales of just really, really beautiful things that we saw. The ride is rough, but mostly not terrifying. I did this for almost 30 years. I have white hair. And aside from, I tell people when I started, my hair was dark brown. you don't do unconventional aviation for years without having some white knuckle experiences.
Yeah, but you know what? I was wondering if you could, because you talk about these beautiful moments, and yes, you're looking at a storm from a very different perspective most of us will never see. But in those moments, did you ever stop and say, "Wow, this moment is beautiful," but underneath all this, that storm is destructive.
Yeah, but if it's out in the middle of the ocean, it's inconveniencing.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example. On broadcast, CNN had pictures of the devastation in the islands. And it looked like the worst of what happened with Andrew here. And if you have an ounce of compassion, you feel very, very sad that people die and their lives are disrupted, and the psychological scars go on for decades for some people.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is, if you look at the statistics of people in the U.S. being killed by hurricanes from 1900 through the early 21st century, the number of deaths went down by a half every 25 years because of more accurate forecasts and better communication. So the more you know, the less horrendous the experience is. We get people out of the storm surge is the big one that prevents mortality. And we're building, if a house is built to the modern building code, they're more wind resistant. Rising seas and storm surge and freshwater flooding, those are a lot tougher to deal with.
Yeah, you touched on this a little bit just a little while ago, and I wanted to know, where are we in this conversation about the role climate change is having on the impact on hurricanes. Are storms really getting bigger, stronger, worse because of it?
Well, there have been some statistical studies based on satellite data that claim that the strongest storms are getting stronger. And there's a very solidly, very credible theoretical argument that should happen. But when you look at damage in the U.S., because you have a bad year and then not much happens for a few years, then there's another bad year and maybe another one and then another lull. It's very difficult to see a trend. I'm doing some work. It's not funded. It's just what I do on a boring Friday afternoon that points to an increase in hurricane damage above what you'd expect because the economy's bigger, that probably is attributable to climate change. And the conventional wisdom in my field is that there may be a trend, but it's hard to see.
But outside of damage, outside of that, just looking at storms, their size, their strength, and again, the frequency, can we see that there's a change?
It's really tough because we observe so much better. Stuff happened out in the ocean 50 years ago or 100 years ago that we didn't know about. And accurate intensity estimations only been around, maybe 60 years. And there's also a natural cycle of kind of biblical 30 years of destructive hurricanes, 30 years of less destructive hurricanes, and you've got to be careful to correct for that cycle. And make it even worse, you can make an argument with all the water that's melting out of the glaciers in Greenland, the natural cycle isn't working the way it used to. So it's a tough problem. But again, there's this convincing theoretical argument that the strongest storms should get stronger. But it's not necessarily that stronger wind makes a more destructive hurricane. Think of Harvey,
right,
where it was all flooding. The fact that the storm stopped, it didn't rain harder than any other hurricane, but it rained longer.
Yeah. I'm talking with Hugh Willoughby. He is a professor at FIU's Department of Earth and Science and a former director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Hurricane Research Division. And we're talking about how Dorian may be changing the way we view hurricanes. I want to get into this aspect of it, though, Professor, is, you know, the Caribbean and the Bahamas probably get hit more frequently. I mean, I have to look at the data, but, you know, they're going to be in front of the storm before Florida will get hit. But we don't know what the damage is going to be. We know that it's probably going to be extensive in the Bahamas. But what do you see as the challenge when it comes to rebuilding on these islands after we've cleared up, about being more resilient? Or is it just that maybe certain places are just not good places to live?
the last of your, the thing on the, after the last or is a scary thing. And that may be true of South Florida too, depending on how fast the sea rises. In the short run, you can build, residences and apartment, but well, structures in general, to make them more wind resistant. You can design multi-story structures so that the ground floor can flood without a whole lot of damage. It's called wet flood proofing. In the short run, you can do that sort of thing. We in South Florida are going to face that issue. I tend to be less pessimistic about the rate of sea level rise than most of my colleagues, but if I'm wrong, they're right. And that's just going to be a tough problem. Imagine 100 years from now or 150 years or 200 years, imagine being the politician who has to make the decision to abandon New Orleans. That's a scary thought.
Mm-hmm.
And we may face that, and we may face similar decisions in the islands. That's the reality. I think we may be, when we talk about climate change, we tend to be kind of doctrinaire about the science, But in terms of policy, we really ought to be working on emissions. Buying pumps and raising roadbeds is putting the Band-Aid on a much more serious problem.
Yeah.
And if we humans don't change our ways, we're going to be in for some bad things happening.
Now you talk about, you know, what it might be like for a politician some point in the future on any coastal city to have to say, we're going to have to abandon some parts of our city because we just can't do anything about it. But what about what may come before that is insurance. And that's a question for, you know, about Florida a lot. But it's this idea that, okay, we have the storms. We also have the rising seas. At one point, do insurance companies say, you know what? It's just not worth doing business in the Bahamas. It's not worth doing business in Florida.
Yeah. But let me offer you another thought. Insurance companies don't just write a check out of their checking account when your house gets blown down. They also buy insurance that by its nature is international reinsurance. And imagine a storm like Dorian going through Miami and then hitting New Orleans as Katrina 2. So you end up with huge Andrew on steroids in Miami and Katrina in New Orleans. If you can do just sort of rough numbers, and worst case, which probably once in a thousand years, is $500 billion. And there may not be, well, there isn't right now, enough reinsurance to cover that. So you'd be looking at massive failures of commercial insurance companies. And even if you, the federal government does something like flood insurance, but for the wind hazard, wind peril as well, it gets to be really expensive. And you know, people in Colorado are not going to be enthusiastic about paying taxes to cover that.
But you know what? I mean, you, because you bring that up, that's an interesting point. And I'm wondering, you know, you said, you know, every generation or every so many years, you see these big storms. And we keep hearing those generational storms or those storms of the century are becoming more prevalent. So, I mean, I'm just wondering how people in finance and insurance and politicians are thinking about the areas that may be harder to insure.
Yeah, and the insurance companies use statistical models. Basically, what they're interested in is how much are they going to have to pay in an average year? And how long is it going to be before a really bad event would cause the company to go under? And as long as that wait period for the second thing is 100 years, the CEO, he gets real nervous when there's a storm closing in, but he kind of figures he'll retire and get his retirement rather than go to jail. But that's exactly right. Now the models that they use don't include the effect of climate change. And we'd have to be careful about how we did it, because the big one is still pretty rare. And so it's going to take a lot of careful thought on how to predict what the financial impacts are going to be. And we may get to the point where, just as you say, they're unsustainable.
It's interesting you say that, though. And again, I'm not the scientist, but I mean, I think of you mentioned Harvey. I think of Michael, and Michael didn't hit a very populated area, but it ballooned into a Category 5 in a very short period of time. Dorian could have just headed straight west and hit all of us. It just seems like, I'm just looking at what I've seen over the years, having spent 40 years in Florida, having been through all kinds of storms. It just seems like there's more of them than there used to be.
If you go back to the 40s, starting in the late 30s and sort of into the 60s, which was the cyclic change in hurricane activity, was in its most active phase. It was a lot like it is now, but there were a lot fewer people living here.
Yeah.
And most of them didn't have any insurance. This isn't unprecedented, but it's difficult to know what the future holds. And there are all kinds of problems that we as a society don't deal very well with. I came here in 1974 to graduate school with the idea of looking for a flying job with the Hurricane Research Division, and it worked out just fine. But I came here because this is ground zero for Atlantic hurricanes. It's what I wanted to do. And what I don't see over this time is a, where you look at it and you say, holy Toledo, it's different from the past. But we may be headed that way.
I see. And thank you for pointing that out. I want to, you know, to make sure that we're not making it seem like it's something it's not. One thing, though, I've read a couple of places is that there's been a question about should we add another category. Category 5 is the worst, but we've seen storms now reach 180, 190 miles per hour and more. And Dorian, of course, the strongest to hit the Bahamas. Should they ever consider Category 6?
Okay. This actually gets into your business. Categories are good for two things. If you're making if you're writing a paper about hurricanes, that gives you the bins for your histogram, which is convenient. The other thing it does is it communicates the level of danger. 5 is a lot bigger than 1, but if I say 110 knots. And 160 knots. For people who don't think about this all the time, they're both a lot of wind. And the number, what happens when you hear those numbers is that's a big number.
Right.
In people's minds. But on the other hand, there's a bigger psychological distance between 5 and 1 than there is between 75 knots and 150 knots.
Right, exactly.
And so it's a communications thing. And if you add another, people are used to it, it communicates with them well. And I think it's one of those things where you might want to think about it, but this is something that works pretty well, and there are other problems like distinguishing the storm surge and the freshwater flooding, being able to describe storm surge and freshwater flooding the same way we do wind with categories. I like the idea of using colors for storm surge and putting the colors on maps, so that you know if you're in the red zone or the blue zone or the green zone.
Yeah. Only because of time, I have to finish up here, but I did want to ask you this question because going back in the research, I had seen that in the past, you know, people have always tried to figure out ways to control, or if not at least manipulate Mother Nature, that there was conversations many years ago, many, many years ago, about how to stop a hurricane. And one of the ideas was an atomic explosion. Is that true?
People have suggested it. I mean, you know, atomic bombs give you the notion of power over humans, at least. But there's a couple of ways to think about it. What I've been saying all the time, this question's come up because of the president's recent pronouncement. One simple way to understand it is the worst hurricane landfall is a lot better than the best thermonuclear war. And the other thing is a thunderstorm, just an ordinary South Florida thunderstorm on an August afternoon, releases the same amount of energy as a fairly substantial nuclear weapon, but it does it in a half an hour instead of in a microsecond.
Yeah.
And what the atmosphere does is it responds on that time scale of the thunderstorm. So you get a big bang, a flash of bright light, and then that heat is just like the heat that comes from water condensing into rain after that. There's a reason why a mushroom cloud looks like a thunderstorm.
Right. Have there ever been, I mean, like any kind of legitimate scientific ideas to trying to stop a hurricane?
Yeah, actually, one of the reasons I came here was there was a project called Project Storm Fury. If you think about Dorian, they talk about eyewall replacements, where new eyewall forms around the old one. In the 60s and the 70s, the idea was to build a new eyewall by cloud seeding.
Oh.
They hadn't looked enough at unmodified hurricanes to know that it happened naturally. And so it was mainstream science. Leaders in the field, papers were published in the journal Science. You know, the best journals. And they seeded 4 hurricanes, 8 cries, 2 per hurricane, 50% apparent success rate. Problem was, the experimental design said storms like Dorian, right before it hit the Bahamas, tiny eye, very intense. Those are exactly the storms that make natural eye wall replacements, we now know.
Yeah.
And it's a cautionary tale about science. I've been around long enough that I've seen multiple cycles of what everybody knows becoming what nobody believes. And that's one of the examples.
Right.
It's an absolutely beguiling idea. And you don't want to have a closed mind, but there's also a fairly high level of proof if you want to do something like that.
Right, right. Well, I'm going to have to stop on that point, but that is a fascinating cover part of the conversation. Hugh Willoughby, again, is a professor at FIU's Department of Earth and Science, again, former director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Hurricane Research Division. Professor, such a pleasure. Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Later in the program, by the way, we're going to be discussing how parents can best approach the stressful topic of hurricanes with their kids. What is that approach? What have you talked to your kids about it? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Coming up next, we're going to talk about relief efforts to the Bahamas. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the death toll in the Bahamas because of Hurricane Dorian is at 5, expected to rise in the coming days. Numerous organizations around South Florida already engaging in relief efforts to raise funds, needed supplies, and to get them out to those areas. WLRN reporter Nadesh Green has been following up on the hashtag Bahamas Strong and all of those relief efforts. Nadesh, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've been attempting to connect with folks throughout the Caribbean, but what communication is really tough right now.
Yes, communication is hard. I think the quickest way to reach folks right now is via WhatsApp. And even on WhatsApp, some of the videos or audio messages aren't going through, but text messages are going through via WhatsApp. And so that's how a lot of folks are keeping in touch with family members or just hearing directly from folks on the ground how things are going.
So right now we know, the few videos that seem to get through, a lot of damage construction, sea levels have risen, lots of flooding in a lot of places, a lot of people missing. But where do we know the greatest need is right now?
Right now, I think the greatest needs are likely going to be the northern part of the Bahamas that was really hard hit, the Abaco Islands and Grand Bahama in particular. So we're seeing a lot of focus there. We're hearing from, you know, Bahamian government officials that it's really hard to say what the needs are right this moment because they're still assessing those needs, right? Up until the water recedes, you really can't get into some of the communities still because there's, you know, over 5 feet, 10 feet of water in some areas. So they're still assessing those needs, but we know that likely there will be hundreds of homes that have been destroyed or greatly damaged. And we know that the death toll so far at last check, I believe, was 5 people dead. But again, we'll know more when it's safe to get into some of the communities. But right now, we just know it's hard hit. But those numbers and that information will be coming out in the coming days.
We talked about it yesterday, some of the relief efforts already underway. But what about South Florida governments? What have we heard about what they're doing in getting ready to lend a hand and help?
I think all over South Florida, from Palm Beach County to Monroe, we're seeing all types of folks stepping up to provide relief efforts. City of Miami and Miami-Dade County government have designated locations. All fire departments in City of Miami are designated drop-offs for relief efforts. The county has opened up some spots as well for relief efforts, like the Joseph A. Caleb Center and the main library downtown. There are churches that have opened their doors. The Archdiocese of Miami has its relief effort. Mercy Corps has their relief effort. So we're seeing the South Florida community come together. There's a drop-off spot at a marina in Monroe County. I mean, we should have the full list online at WLRN.org, but we're seeing, again, a really huge groundswell of support for the Bahamian people. We have a lot of Bahamians among us here in our community.
Yeah, we talked about that yesterday.
Large Caribbean population here. And, you know, whenever something happens in the Caribbean, even if you're not from the Bahamas, you know, we're Caribbean strong. So you're seeing the Haitian community, the Jamaican community, Bajans, everyone coming together, the African-American community, even, you know, everyone is coming together for the Bahamian community.
Yeah, it was mentioned, too, that people remember that. So many Bahamians played a part in building this city.
Bahamians literally built Miami. It's my favorite Miami historical fact.
Yeah.
Right before Miami was a city. I mean, when we talk about Henry Flagler Railroad, I mean, Bahamian workers were were experts on our landscape, right? Like on how to build on this type of limestone ridge. And so Bahamian workers came over and were instrumental. Bahamians were the first large immigrant wave, was the first large immigrant wave in Miami. We like to talk about modern immigration and we think Cuban and the Haitian community, but Bahamians was first large immigrant wave here in Miami and quite literally built not just Miami, but Monroe County, Palm Beach, Broward counties. We have like a huge history of history that's rooted in the Bahamas. That, I mean, Miami's original, you know, documents to incorporate a good majority of the black men who signed our incorporation papers for the city of Miami were Bahamian men. The Miami Times was founded by Bahamian. Miami Times is the largest black newspaper in the Southeast and is based here in Miami. And that was founded by a Bahamian publisher. So, you know, when we think of like Miami's roots, you cannot divorce that from the Bahamas.
So again, as you said, a lot of different groups are collecting supplies right now. We have a list on our website at WLRN.org so that you can find out where is somewhere near you. You can get information there. Nadej, always a pleasure. Thank you. Finishing up the program today, I want to move over to Palm Beach County, speaking of, and find out what's been going on up there. Let's reach out to our WLRN Palm Beach County reporter, Madeline Fox. Maddie, where are you at now today?
I am still in the Emergency Operations Center in West Palm Beach.
So you've had the chance, though, to get out and kind of see what's been going on. How would you describe what's been happening in Palm Beach County? And are people still kind of boarded up and hiding, or are people trying to get back to somewhat normal?
I actually haven't been out since for about 24 hours. But what I've seen online mostly is that it seems like people are getting out a little bit. There has been some flooding along the coast. I think a popular restaurant in Boynton Beach that's along the intercoastal called Two Georges got quite a bit of water. And then some businesses I know are opening back up or at least going back to check things out and get ready to maybe open tomorrow. That's going to be a lot of grocery stores are going to open back up tomorrow. And garbage collection is starting again in unincorporated Palm Beach County tomorrow as well.
Is the airport still closed, or have they announced when they plan to reopen?
They haven't announced when they plan to reopen. They had said that they were going to open it up around 3 p.m. today, but then decided not to. So it's closed for the foreseeable future.
What have you heard from the officials with the county at the EOC as to, you know, how they're moving forward? Again, as the storm is slowly moving up the coast, but it's lost some of its power. And again, it's stayed a pretty good distance away from the coast. But what's their latest? What have they said?
I think they're still really mostly just wanting people to not let down their guard. They seem to be particularly worried that people are going to see that the storm is slowing down and see that it's been downgraded and it doesn't seem to be coming at us and get really cavalier about it. But they said to just still be very aware of wind and water. I think we're bracing for possible tropical storm winds until around 8 tonight. So it's not we're not out of the woods yet.
There are still, because Palm Beach County, I believe, is in a tropical storm warning, shelters are still open, right?
That's right. Yeah, we've still got 11 shelters open. Those are 9 regular, 1 for special needs and 1 for pets. And they've said we're going to keep those open for, I think, as long as we're under a tropical storm warning.
For the most part, what have you heard from officials or authorities as to not only how they've been able to operate these last 24, 48 hours, but what they've seen from folks in Palm Beach County? I mean, we just had Irma not that long ago. Does it seem like people, they know the routine and they follow everything they're supposed to be doing?
I think yes and no. I mean, Florida's seen its fair share of hurricanes, so a lot of people seem to be, you know, they there's a hotline here at the actually just across the way from the Emergency Operations Center that's been getting calls, and they say a lot of the calls they got really peaked a couple of days ago when people were saying, hey, am I in an evacuation zone? Hey, what do I need in my kit? Hey, like all that kind of stuff. And so that to them was kind of encouraging that peaked several days before the storm, because that means people are pretty good about getting ready. But there's always concerns about people who don't know, like didn't get all the information or haven't had the means to prepare very well.
You know, the other thing, too, is we had mentioned it before the storm was threatening the area, that this is also a king tide. So they kind of added on top of the fears of flooding. You did mention one restaurant that did get some flooding. But I mean, have we heard about extensive flooding throughout the area?
I haven't heard a whole lot. Again, I haven't been able to really drive the roads myself, but I know flooding is a big concern, and it does look like there's been some along the waterways. And in fact, those were evacuation zones that have been since Sunday. So water is definitely a concern.
The other thing, too, to remind people of is the fact that, there is the issue of price gouging that does occur during this time when the storm is coming through. There is a price gouging hotline, by the way, that you could call the state if you think that is happening. Maddie, have you seen anything like that? Some places are trying to reopen, but, I know people also trying to get gas or basic necessities. Have you heard of any complaints or any issues with that?
So the state attorney for Palm Beach County, Dave Ehrenberg, did tell us that the state's gotten that hotline, which is a statewide hotline, has gotten about 1,000 reports of price gouging as of yesterday in Palm Beach County alone. We don't know how many of those are like repeat reports or how many of them were even substantiated, but it is something that people are looking for and it is something that people are seeing. My understanding is that price gouging is just a fine. So some businesses may decide that they'll make more money in the price gouging, then they'll have to cough up in penalties. So,
yeah. Remind people again what emergency officials are telling people in Palm Beach County. Again, even though the storm has been downgraded, it hasn't passed by yet, and it's still there. There's still a danger.
That's right. They're mostly saying stay put. So if you're in a shelter, stay in a shelter. If you're at home, you're not in an evacuation zone, stay there and kind of just hunker down, because the biggest concern, if there is water or if there's a lot of wind, is trees coming down and power lines coming down and causing problems, especially if they're in water, and then flooding. So basically they're saying don't relax just yet. I know it's hard.
Yeah. Madeline Fox, again, our WLRN Palm Beach County reporter at the Emergency Operations Center up there in Palm Beach County. Maddie, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for this Tuesday, September 3rd. So again, just a reminder that you want to stay tuned to WLRN throughout the day. We'll keep you updated on Hurricane Dorian. Again, it's been downgraded to a Category 2. Still, take that serious. A Category 2 is still a very powerful storm. And as we heard from Jeff Huffman, there is the concern of storm surge and flooding, because as we just mentioned, this is a king tide as well. If you live up in Palm Beach County, let us know what's going on up there. Share with us. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Send us photos or video. Tell us about what's been going on and how you've been handling this very slow-moving storm. Again, as we find out what's reopening over time, we'll let you know. If you happen to be out and about, again, please be safe. Let us know what is reopening, what is available, is there still gas anywhere, or basic supplies at the stores. Have the stores reopened at some point? But again, stay tuned to WLRN. We'll keep you informed as to everything that's going on with Hurricane Dorian. We are almost out of this, I promise. It's almost done. Again, I want to thank everybody who's helped with the program today. Just mentioned that tomorrow we're going to be live again, and we'll just keep on keeping you informed on what's happening with Dorian. By then, hopefully it's moved out of our area. But a lot of what we're going to be reporting is obviously the damage and destruction that's happened in the Bahamas. We're going to try to get you the latest information about the destruction, unfortunately, we expect the fatality rate to go up. But right now, again, 5 people confirmed dead. So we'll keep you informed on everything with the Bahamas coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks, as always, for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.